Today's Teisho will be on case 46 in the Wu Meng Quan, in Wu Meng Quan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 46 is entitled, I think we're okay. Thank you. Case 46 is entitled, Proceed On From the Top of the Pole. Sekiso Osho asked, how can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? Another eminent teacher of old said, you who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, you are not yet genuine. Proceed on from the top of the pole, and you will show your whole body in the 10 directions. Mumon's comment, if you go no further and turn your body about, no place is left where you are not the master. But even so, tell me, how will you go on further from the top of the 100-foot pole, eh? Mumon's verse, he darkens the third eye of insight and clings to the first mark on the scale. Although he may sacrifice his life, he is only a blind man leading the blind. Thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen and for doing such a wonderful job. Everybody was sitting so still. This koan is often is an often quoted koan, stepping off the 100-foot pole, and yet I don't know that people really understand what it's all about. It's a pretty dramatic image, right? You're on the top of a 100-foot pole, and you know, basically you've gone as far as you can go. It's a 100-foot pole and you're at the top, the last foot. And you're hanging on, and now you say, well, what do I do? And the instructions are, basically, proceed on from the top of the pole. So it's like, keep going. You know, one of the, pardon me, one of the great mysteries of Buddhism is its attitude towards rebirth. You know, in the West, rebirth is a totally positive idea, right? So, you know, if we say our society is going through a rebirth, you know, that's a super positive idea. It's like we were dead, but now we've come back to life. See, so many ways, this idea of like a rebirth is a positive metaphor in the West. Birth and rebirth are positive. If you read Buddhist sutras, though, if you read Buddhist sutras or you read Buddhist literature, sooner or later you're going to come across a very different view of rebirth. So in almost all the sutras, rebirth is a symbol of big problem. If you read the sutras, you'll see how can we avoid rebirth? How can we avoid rebirth? Some of you are probably too young to know about George Harrison, the Beatle. But in one of his songs, he has a line that says, keep me free from birth. Keep me free from birth. So, you know, this is really a strange thing, right? In the West, we think of birth and rebirth as totally positive things. Renaissance, like the Renaissance means the rebirth, you know, coming back to born again, basically. In Christianity, people are born again, right? This is a big thing in some kinds of Christianity. And Buddhism says, you know, birth and rebirth, that's a big problem. And it's possible to be really puzzled by that. You know, some people would say, yes, you know, Buddhism is so pessimistic, you know. Very pessimistic, very, you know, there are people who don't understand Buddhism very well. And because Buddhism starts with the Four Noble Truths, that first noble truth is the fact that people suffer. You know, so people who are sort of outside the Buddhist world look at that and think, oh, you know, that's really gloomy. You start with suffering, you know, and now you don't want to be alive, basically. So I remember long ago when I was just getting into Buddhism, I looked in a, my parents had a almanac, a world almanac. And it was in the living room, and it was as close as my parents got to having information. You know, this was long before the internet, so we didn't have an encyclopedia set at home. There was an encyclopedia in my classroom, but we had an almanac. That it was like the 1970 World Almanac, and it listed, among other things, all the world religions, and it said something about Buddhism. It said basically, Buddhists strive for the void or non-existence, right? I couldn't imagine who would want to strive for the void, right? You know, but this whole idea of how do I avoid birth or how do I avoid rebirth is a big issue, you know, it's a big sticking point. And it seems to suggest that maybe Buddhism is life evading or world evading. You know, but actually, you know, to the Buddhist way of thinking, you know, in Buddhist scriptures, in Buddhist sutras, and in Buddhist philosophy, you can't have life without death. And so, you know, basically, life and death are always a pair in the Buddhist way of thinking about things. Life and death go together. So you can't have a rebirth without having a re-death, you know. So you know, we in the West would like to think like endless birth, but or we just like to dwell on the birth part. But you know, for Buddhists, birth and death both go together, and both are really sort of like not fully capturing the essence of our existence. What we call birth and what we call death aren't really the way we understand them. Because actually, from the Buddhist point of view, there isn't really such a thing as birth or such a thing as death. You know, when in the early Buddhist sutras, in the Pali Sutras, these are the earliest sutras we have. They were written down around 100 BC, and they were passed on before that time orally. There were monks whose job it was just to remember sutras. And they would periodically get together and compare their recitations to make sure they were all remembering the sutras properly. This is why all the early sutras began with the words, "Thus have I heard." So, you know, right after the Buddha's death, all the monks who had been his companions got together and they tried to commit to memory all the teachings they remembered. And they would always start the sutras by saying, basically, this is what I heard from the Buddha's own mouth. So all the sutras began that way. And the earliest sutras, the Buddha describes in a number of them his experience of enlightenment. And if you have a chance to read some of those early Pali Sutras, they're not easy reading. But they're probably worth reading. There's one sutra called the Sutra of the Noble Search. And I highly recommend that sutra. If you wanted to read any early Buddhist sutra, I would say please read that one. When the Buddha leaves home and goes to study meditation with these meditation masters, and then eventually goes off on his own and has his enlightenment experience, he describes that experience rather briefly. He doesn't say much about it. But when he tries to find words to describe it, he calls it the deathless, the deathless. In other places, when the Buddha tries to describe enlightenment, he calls it the unborn, unborn. So, you know, we think of rebirth as positive. We think of birth as positive. And of course, it's great to be born. And we all have those moments where we feel like we're coming back to life. But, you know, actually, to call them rebirth from the Buddhist standpoint is a misunderstanding. You know, birth and death are not liberated conditions. They're not an accurate understanding of how things really are. You know, when the Buddha woke up, he experienced what he called the deathless, and in other places, the unborn. So when the Buddha was describing enlightenment, he didn't say, you know, as Westerners might expect. You know, Westerners would say, I'm born again. I've been reborn. He doesn't say that. He says, I have entered a realm beyond birth and death. And what he means is, one way to put it is, the experience of enlightened mind, which many human beings have had before and after the Buddha, what we call birth and what we call death don't seem to accurately describe our existence. Basically, birth and death are thought of very differently in the Buddhist sutras. And when you read the sutras and you see somebody saying, how can I prevent rebirth? You know, it might give you a jolt because, of course, in the West, we all want rebirth. But actually, the condition of awakening is beyond birth and death. In that state of mind, neither of those words make any sense. So if you think about Buddhism as a philosophy, that's great. You know, but it's really not a philosophy. You know, when you read the sutras, like the Heart Sutra, or when you read the Diamond Sutra, you're not really reading a philosophical statement. You're reading a statement or a description of how the world feels in a certain state of mind. So when you we recite every morning the Heart Sutra, and in the Heart Sutra, we're told that there is a state of emptiness, and in that, if you stay in that state of emptiness, all suffering goes away. See, now that's not a philosophical statement. It's an account of how it feels when you enter blank mind. If you have had some kind of a personal tragedy and you can't get free from it, I highly recommend sitting down on the cushion and entering Mushin. When you're on the cushion and you begin to have pain in your legs, if you visualize your pain, it becomes more real and urgent and less bearable. But if you feel a little pain in your legs when you're meditating and you follow the breath out, and you go to that blank place at the end of your breath, which we call mu, or what in Sanskrit is called shunyata. If you go into deep shunyata, you go into deep mushin, you'll notice that the pain recedes. And if you keep practicing meditation, you'll eventually get to a place where the pain disappears or it becomes very far away. And when that happens, it can sometimes feel incredibly liberating. So, you know, this is something that you will experience if you just keep practicing Zen. You know, even if you're just a beginner, if you focus on your breath and you sweep the pain away, if you can get into that place at the end of your breath where your mind is like a blank slate, you'll notice that when you're in that place, your pain recedes quite a bit. This is just an elementary state of encountering emptiness. But if you keep practicing encountering emptiness, you can eventually reach a condition which is really imperturbable. It's imperturbable. You know, so even if you're in great emotional distress, if you sit down on the cushion and you're practiced at entering that emptiness, it'll be like all your suffering will go away. I mean, this has happened to me again and again. You know, I know that, you know, when I've both of my parents have died, and I loved both of my parents very much. And in fact, I was with my father and my mother both when they died. And, you know, it's quite moving to be with people you love and have them just, die right in front of you. And it's quite an emotional charge. And, you know, especially in my father's case, you know, he was, he had lung cancer, and it was very difficult, very painful for him. And he wasn't really able to deal with it very well. He really suffered emotionally knowing he was going to die. And he had a lot of emotional distress as he was leaving this world, you know. And it caused me a lot of suffering because I wasn't able to help him. And at some point, you know, after he had died and everybody sort of had gone off on their own, I definitely sat down on the cushion. And I had a fair amount of emotional distress myself. And because of that, I went into deep mushin. And I entered very, very deep samadhi. And it was just like all of that dropped away. And I felt this tremendous, like, surge of, you could say, optimism or energy. And this is what the Heart Sutra is promising. So it's not a philosophical statement. It's a statement of how things feel when you enter a certain condition of awareness. And if you just hang in with your practice long enough and you're diligent, you'll begin to enter some of these states. Definitely most people who practice Zen for a couple of years can begin to enter deep mushin. And at many times in my life when I've had a crisis, it's worked like magic for me, you know, and it will for you too. You know, another very wonderful sutra that we use in the Zen tradition is the Diamond Sutra. And in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Well, I mean, actually, that doesn't make much sense as a philosophical proposition. So if you have people who you love and care about, and you try to communicate your Zen insights, they might not appreciate it. I say this from long experience living with people who don't appreciate Zen tradition and whom I love very much. So if I say, oh, you know, form is emptiness, it's like this, you just get blank stares. But if you've been practicing meditation for a while, you probably already, even if the words form is emptiness and emptiness is form seem confusing to you intellectually, you're already there in your experience. You know, so basically, if you're on day 3 of a sesshin, or you've been meditating for 8 hours in deep mushin, you know, it's very clear that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Your experience of things, it feels absolutely indistinguishable from your experience of emptiness. So when you go into deep mushin on the cushion on a Saturday, you know, if you've been sitting here for 5 sits, you know, by the 5th sit, your legs probably hurt you a little bit. And you go into deep mushin and your pain recedes, and then you get off the cushion. And, you know, when you get back in your car, that may feel like form, not emptiness, if that's making any sense. In other words, that emptiness may seem very far away. But if you keep practicing meditation, actually, your experience of form, of emptiness, seems to be present all the time. So that deep state of samadhi you enter at special occasions on the cushion eventually is your baseline consciousness. And it's your baseline consciousness as you're eating your dinner and as you're drinking your tea and as you're doing your taxes. Believe me, it's true. So at some point it becomes obvious that emptiness is form and form is emptiness. See? And at some point, if you practice meditation, it becomes obvious that neither birth nor death actually exist as we understand them. And I hope you will take my word for it. It doesn't mean that when people you love die, you won't cry. But what we call birth and what we call death are not the way we understand them. And the way we understand them is like deficient or inadequate understanding. And how to really understand them, we have to discover for ourselves in our meditation practice. Just as if somebody told you about emptiness and you had never meditated, you wouldn't know what they were talking about. And you might think, oh yeah, Buddhism sounds so pessimistic. Empty, meditating on emptiness, how terrible. But if you try it, if you've ever encountered that emptiness, it's incredibly energizing and purifying. So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, maybe you're in emotional distress. You have all these things you have to do, the sense of pressure is building up, and you keep watching your breath, and at some point, you just enter this blankness. And everything is washed away. And when everything is washed away, you begin to have this wonderful sense of spaciousness or energy. Now, unless you've had that experience, you can't really describe it to somebody who hasn't had that experience. And fortunately, to understand what it means when the Buddha says no birth and no death, you don't have to die. You know, there was a very famous Zen master. Somebody said to him, what happens after we die? And he said, I don't know, I'm not dead yet. So fortunately, not necessary to die to understand what that statement means, no birth and no death, this deathless and unborn. But it does take a lot of sitting. So, you know, one reason Buddhists find the idea of rebirth troubling or see it as negative is because so often we repeat and repeat and repeat our familiar ways of experiencing the world, you know? So our biggest problem in a certain sense is that we can't get free from our mental habits. You know, the word in Buddhism, there is a word nirvana. Nirvana means like an enlightened state. And the opposite of nirvana is samsara, samsara. So nirvana is an enlightened state, and samsara is the opposite of an enlightened state. And the word samsara actually means going around in a circle. So, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, a negative state is constantly being reborn into the self we have always been. See, if this is making any sense. So, you know, the problem for Buddhists, at least the problem for people, is that we can't change easily once we become committed to certain ways of being. Even if those ways of being cause us great suffering, it's very hard to change. You know, I have a friend of mine who is who's a therapist. And she doesn't talk about her particular patients, but she definitely has told me that, you know, there are many patients that she's had who have been coming to see her for 10 years or more, and very little change. Even though they're unhappy, you know, it's very difficult for them to let go of their mental habits. So, you know, this is sort of what Buddhists mean when they talk about rebirth being a problem. You know, you have difficulty. Maybe somebody has hurt your feelings. Maybe you had a friend in childhood you trusted with your secrets, and that person blabbed them all over the school. You know, that can become a life-transforming experience, right? And, you know, you might find throughout your life that it's very difficult for you to trust anybody. You know, when I was a kid, I grew up in Baltimore for some of my childhood, and Baltimore was a really, really violent place when I was living there. And I used to have to, when I was trying to go to school, I used to really struggle trying to get to school without getting beaten up, and then getting home was a challenge too. And I got beaten up fairly often, so for some of my life, especially the early part of my life, I was very reserved around people. It was like I was almost waiting for them to hit me. In fact, you know, one time when I was just starting to date my wife, we went to a restaurant, and she started to reach for something on the table, and I recoiled like she was going to punch me. And she was shocked. You know, she said, "I'm not going to punch you." Well, I guess in my life I had been prepared to get punched a lot. So, you know, how do we free ourselves from those habits? How do we free ourselves from those mental habits? And so, you know, in Buddhism, the problem is not trying to be reborn, but trying not to be reborn as the person we've always been. That's like the fundamental problem from the Buddhist point of view. How can we go forward and be like really different people and not just keep repeating those samsaric cycles? You know, Zen Buddhism, or Buddhism in general, is about freeing ourselves from our, you could say, like our conditioned responses. Zen practice is about entering this state of emptiness. And then, you know, it's very important for you to, you could say, challenge yourself by doing things that make you nervous, or make you afraid, or make you anxious. You know, in traditional Zen training, in like a monastery, if you read Zen stories, you often hear these stories where the master, the Roshi or the Shifu, will come into the room and he'll say to the monks, "You know, you guys are not making any progress. You know, you are Rinzai, founder of this particular lineage, used to come in and say to his monks, 'You guys are just sitting on your ass all day. You're not really waking up. You're just clinging to your familiar comfort.'" And one of the reasons Zen teachers invented koans is because this can be a problem. You know, if people use their meditation practice simply to come in, sit down on the cushion, quiet their minds, and enter stillness, that can be tremendously helpful, but it's not really ultimately liberating. Because you're just clinging to a state of mind that's quickly becomes familiar, and it doesn't allow you to challenge those mental habits that would be really the beginning of self-transformation or self-liberation. So, you know, in Zen practice, we have developed this system of koan training. And if you've done koans, you know that they're actually very difficult and somewhat unpleasant to work with. I hope I'm not going to put you off, but, you know, the whole point of a koan is to push you beyond your comfort zone. Even Zen training does that just in a physical way. So, you know, if you sit once in a while, once a week, that's better than not sitting at all. But, you know, the best circumstance in your Zen training is to practice, like, multiple sits so that you reach a point where you're a little bit uncomfortable in your sitting and you have to go deeper. And if you don't do that, it's very difficult for you to get into deeper states of concentration. You know, the same thing is true in yoga. You know, in yoga, if you always just do the asana exactly the same way, you never gain flexibility. So the essence of yoga is each time you practice an asana, you go a little bit beyond your comfort zone. And in that way, you gain greater flexibility. Well, it's the same thing in Zen practice. You know, if you sit an hour, that's better than half an hour, and especially it's better if after the first half hour you're feeling a little uncomfortable. You have to go deeper into that emptiness. Koan practice works like that also. So, this koan, stepping off the top of the 100-foot pole, is really about doing something you don't want to do. So, you know, if the teacher were to give you, if I give you this koan at some point, you sit down on the cushion, you straighten your back, and you say, stepping off, stepping off, stepping off. And at first, you know, working with a koan like this is just an academic exercise. You know, you're just going into deep mushin and you're saying, stepping off, stepping off, stepping off. But at some point, you know, you're going to begin to realize there is a step in your life you have to take that you haven't taken. And this is definitely going to happen to you if you work with the koan. There's something in your life you haven't done that you're going to have to do if you're going to become more fully awake. You know, I've actually given this koan to people who actually have quit doing Zen because they haven't wanted to take that step. So, this actually involves somebody who has no longer practicing with our group. So I'm not going to be revealing any secrets that violate anybody's confidence. But many years ago, like 15 years ago, there was a person sitting in our group. And she came to the group because she was having a lot of unhappiness in her life. And she began to come quite regularly to the sits. She would be here at least every week, and then eventually almost every time. And then, you know, basically was coming on Saturday. And it was really wonderful to see her practice, because at first she could sit comfortably for about 15 minutes. Then she could sit for 20 minutes and so on, and eventually she could sit for an hour without moving. And I'm always looking for people who want to practice Zen. So I was very excited about this person. You know, I was encouraging her, and she started coming to Sesshin and so on. And she developed the ability to sit for long periods of time, and she was working through her koans. And then I gave her this koan. And, you know, for a long time, she would just come in and tell me, you know, I nothing's coming up on the cushion. You know, nothing's coming up. And you know, I would just say, well, come on, you know, you're doing such a great job with your practice. Don't worry. You know, just trust the process. Work with the koan. And then, you know, after a couple sesshins, she came in to see me and she said, you know, I don't think this has anything to do with the koan. But she told me that basically her husband and she had a really unhappy relationship and had had a really unhappy relationship for years. And that basically, you know, her husband hadn't been faithful to her, and basically, they had this really unhappy relationship, and she said, you know, I keep thinking about this while I'm working with the koan, and she was saying, stepping off, and you know, at some point, she would come in and talk to me and we would go over this same territory again and again. And I think what she really wanted to do was to leave her husband, you know, because she was so unhappy. And she couldn't step off that 100-foot pole. She just couldn't or wouldn't step off that 100-foot pole. And, you know, my job as a Zen teacher is never to say, you know, don't you see, you've got to dump that guy. You know, that's not my job, and it's not my choice. It's her life, right? But, you know, we kept circling around and around this issue, and eventually she just stopped doing Zen. And I think she'd reached a point in her life, a place in her life, where, you know, her, we would say in Zen, her true nature, you know, was telling her something important and that she didn't want to hear it because it meant changing her life in a really radical way. And I myself don't know what decision I would have made if I were in her position. You know, I can't really say, oh, if I were that person, I would definitely leave my husband and, you know, basically find a job for very little money. Live in an apartment, and you know, I can't really say I would do that. It would be terrifying to do that, actually. But you know, something inside of her was telling her to do that. And you know, even though we might think of Zen as something we do on the cushion, you know, at some point, it has to be taken into our lives in the way I'm describing. You know, she couldn't go any farther in her practice, opening up as a human being, without taking a real step like this in her life. And, you know, the koan sort of forced her to step off the 100-foot pole in a way that she just didn't want to do. So, you know, even though she didn't do this, you know, I don't know really what happened to her, and I hope maybe she and her husband worked it out. But, you know, in Zen practice, you know, we learn to trust that part of ourselves which gives us those instructions. You know, in Zen we call that being true to our true nature. Being true to our true nature. As you go through Zen practice or Zen training, you go from koan to koan to koan, you realize that inside of yourself, there's a stranger you could say, who is wiser than you are and really fearless and can be, like, totally trusted. You know, that's really the truth, in my opinion. You know, in Zen we talk about true nature. You know, you have a conscious mind that says, I'm Kurt. But, you know, deep in your consciousness, behind that blank wall of Mushin, there's a deeper intelligence which is wiser than you are and can be trusted like 100%. That's the view in Zen practice. That's a view of Zen tradition. We say that's Buddha nature. Inside of you is an enlightened being who is trying to help you and get free from your obstacles. And, you know, when we first start doing Zen practice, we don't listen to that voice. We don't trust it. That's why we're doing Zen. So, you know, one of the reasons people can be unhappy is because they don't listen to their enlightened person inside. And so they come to do Zen, and at first I say, please just call Mu and see what happens. Just go into emptiness and see what happens. And people think, nothing's going to happen. But they go into deep emptiness, and all of a sudden something happens, something remarkable happens. And then I give them a koan, and they think, I'll never answer this koan, but suddenly they answer the koan. So a lot of Zen practice is learning how to trust that enlightened person inside of you. And that's very hard for people to believe in, right? People will believe in a God who lives in heaven before they will believe in an enlightened person in themselves. But, you know, the enlightened person in yourself is really there, and you can trust it 24/7 completely. And so a lot of Zen practice is learning how to trust anything, but especially learning how to trust that enlightened Buddha inside of yourself. And so, you know, maybe I made a mistake by giving this woman that koan at that point in her life, right? Maybe I should have waited a few more years before I gave her that koan so she would have developed the trust she needed to step off her pole, her flagpole, her 100-foot pole. But, you know, in Zen practice, we step off the 100-foot pole again and again. That's what real practice is all about. It's constantly going to a place where you don't trust yourself and then learning to trust yourself. Because, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, God is not in heaven. God is in yourself. You know, your enlightened being in yourself is the voice you need to listen to. You know, so Zen, in a way, is about doing what is always a little bit impossible. See? It's always, you know, I'm so sorry that in the United States today, meditation has become associated with mental tranquilization, right? So, you know, lots of people practice what they call mindfulness. And they watch their breath until they enter samadhi and they grow calm, and then they basically get off the cushion and go about their life. But you know, actually that's not what a Buddhist tradition means by mindfulness. And it's a very limiting way of practicing. You know, I think there's something wonderful about encountering obstacles in yourself and then working through those obstacles. You know, when I was about 13 years old, I went on a hike with the Boy Scouts. It was a 50-mile hike. And the Scoutmaster really should have been shot for taking little kids on a 50-mile hike. There's no way we could have done it. And he was so inexperienced, he didn't know that. So we all had these heavy packs, and after walking like 6 miles, we were all sobbing, right? should not have been entrusted with little kids, actually. He was a good man, but he was like a lieutenant colonel in the army, and he was treating 12-year-olds like they were Marines. But, you know, actually, even though I ended that day sobbing, you know, they did scale back the hike. We didn't do 50 miles, and they emptied a lot of our packs out. But, you know, I had only walked in my life maybe, you know, 3 miles to the store and back or something. Walking 5 miles was really hard, but, you know, it was so interesting to realize that my barrier was not real. You know, if somebody had said, how far can you walk, I would have said 3 miles. But, you know, on my first hike with the Boy Scouts, I did 5 miles. I was crying. But, you know, the next day, you know, I realized I'm at my limits when I hit 3 miles, but I'm going to go through the limit. And, you know, when you do that, it feels great if you've ever gotten into jogging or running. You know, the first time you run a mile, maybe you need to go home and rest for the rest of the day. But eventually you try another mile, and, you know, it's hard. You get to that first mile and you think, oh man, I'm never going to make another mile. But then, you know, something inside you clicks on and you do the second mile. And then you do 3 miles. And then one day you think, you know, there's no way I could run 7 miles. And then you run 7 miles. And this is really exhilarating, because you realize we have these boundaries in ourselves. We say, I can't do this. I can't. There's no way. And then you crash right through that boundary. And, you know, doing that gives you that trust in your true nature. You know, there are many things like this. I mean, I have a friend of mine who's a poet, right? And you know, everybody in her life discouraged her from being a poet. She teaches at Rutgers. She's a really great poet. She's a genius, really. When I read her poetry, I just think, and you know, her parents were totally against this. And she herself, when she got started, thought, "There's no way this is going to work. I'm never going to be a poet." And she would cry, and her teachers would reject what she's done. She'd send stuff off to literary journals and they'd reject them. But, you know, she broke through those barriers. And if you practice Zen, you know, you learn to trust your true nature, and you learn not to trust the barrier. You realize that the barrier is kind of an illusion. You know, it's an illusion. We create these arbitrary barriers as part of our self-definition process. We say, I am this, and I couldn't be anything else. You know, but then you crash through the barrier and you realize, that self is not who I really was at all. So, you know, to live the Zen life is to constantly work up against your barriers on the cushion and off the cushion. And basically, you know, when you crash through a barrier, you realize, I am not the person I thought I was. I don't know who I am. See, I mean, you know, being reborn means being Kurt again, right? But to live the Zen life is always to live, you know, just to go through the barrier of Kurt and wind up in a strange place over and over again, if that makes any sense. Practicing Zen means being a stranger to yourself over and over again. But I would say that means being, you know, like radically alive. To be a stranger to yourself over and over again is it's like your life is pure possibility if you can live that way. You know, so that's better than being reborn. At least being reborn as the one person you were. You know, it's being a life of constant trust, and then breaking through barriers and experiencing pure possibility. When the Indian monk Bodhidharma went to China and met Emperor Wu of Liang, Emperor Wu asked him, "Who are you?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." And people either thought he was nuts or they thought he was making a joke, but he was telling the truth. I crash through barriers and I live in pure possibility. See, who cares what I was yesterday? I can be something else now if I crash through my barrier. Sekiso Osho asked, how can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? Impossible, right? It's impossible. I can't change. Another eminent teacher of old said, you who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, see, you may be serene on the cushion, but you've got to break through those barriers. You are not yet genuine. Proceed on from the top of the pole and you will show your whole body in the 10 directions. Your pure possibility. Wumon's comment, if you go on further and turn your body about, no place is left where you are not the master. Even so, tell me, how will you go further on the top of the 100-foot pole, eh? Mumon's verse, he darkens the third eye of insight. In other words, living in uncertainty is liberation if you trust yourself and clings to the first mark on the scale. Even though he may sacrifice his life, he is only a blind man leading the blind. That's supposed to be a bad thing, but actually that's how we discover something new.